God this evening from the book of Numbers. We'll read from chapter 11 and we'll read verses 1 to 20. So Numbers 11, verse 1 to 20. And the people complained in the hearing of the Lord about their misfortunes. And when the Lord heard it, his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some outlying parts of the camp. Then the people cried out to Moses, and Moses prayed to the Lord, and the fire died down. So the name of that place was called Taberah, because of the fire of the Lord burned among them. Now the rabble that was among them had a strong craving. And the people of Israel also wept again and said, "Oh, that we had meat to eat! We remember the fish we ate in Egypt that cost nothing, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. But now our strength is drying up, and there is nothing at all but this manna to look at." Now the manna was like coriander seed, and its appearance like that of dillium. The people went about and gathered it and ground it in handmills, or beat it in mortars and boiled it in pots and made cakes of it. And the taste of it was like the taste of cakes baked with oil. When the dew fell upon the camp in the night, the manna fell with it. Moses heard the people weeping throughout their clans, everyone at the door of his tent. And the anger of the Lord blazed hotly, and Moses was displeased. Moses said to the Lord, "Why have you dealt ill with your servant? And why have I not found favor in your sight, that you lay the burden of all this people on me? Did I conceive all this people? Did I give them birth that you should say to me, 'Carry them in your bosom, as a nurse carries a nursing child,' to the land that you swore to give their fathers? Where am I to get meat to give all this people? For they weep before me and say, 'Give us meat that we may eat.' I am not able to carry all this people alone. The burden is too heavy for me. If you will treat me like this, kill me at once, if I find favor in your sight, that I may not see my wretchedness." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Gather for me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom you know to be the elders of the people and officers over them, and bring them to the tent of meeting, and let them take their stand there with you. And I will come down and talk with you there, and I will take some of the spirit that is on you and put it on them, and they shall bear the burden of the people with you, so that you may not bear it yourself alone. And say to the people, 'Consecrate yourselves for tomorrow, and you shall eat meat, for you have wept in the hearing of the Lord, saying, "Who will give us meat to eat? For it was better for us in Egypt." Therefore the Lord will give you meat, and you shall eat. You shall not eat just one day, or 2 days, or 5 days, or 10 days, or 20 days, but a whole month, until it comes out of your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you, because you have rejected the Lord who is among you, and have wept before him, saying, 'Why did we come out of Egypt?'" Thus says the word of God.
Ecclesiastes, the end of chapter 6 and into chapter 7 again this evening. Ecclesiastes 6 from verse 10. You remember the third sermon in the middle section of Ecclesiastes runs from 6:1 through to 8:13, and last week we looked at particularly the first six verses of chapter 7. We're going to really look at verses 7 to 10, 7 to 12 this evening. So I'm going to read from chapter 6, verse 10, which runs through into chapter 7, verse 12, or verse 14, actually. Sorry. Chapter 6, verse 10. "Whatever has come to be has already been named, and it is known what man is, and that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. The more words, the more vanity. And what is the advantage to man? For who knows what is good for man while he lives, the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? A good name is better than precious ointment, on the day of death than the day of birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of the face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It is better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the song of the fools. For as crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of fools. This also is vanity. Surely oppression drives the wise into madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the heart of fools. Say not, why were the former days better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask this. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, an advantage to those who see the sun. For the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money, and the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful, and in the day of adversity, consider God, who's made the one as well as the other, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. We end the reading there at verse 14. Well, as we've been looking at this particular third sermon, beginning at chapter 6, verse 1, and looking at what it teaches us about wisdom, we've noticed a couple of things, haven't we? We noticed that there are tough experiences in this life. And the two that we've really been focusing on over the last couple of times is in chapter 6, verses 1 to 9, is the problem of wealth. Wealth can bring positive benefits, as we'll see towards the end of the sermon, but the problem of wealth, or the problem of stuff, is what he speaks of, and it gets in the way of a relationship with God. And the other tough experience that we experience in this life, the short life, is the constant reminder of death. We saw that last week, didn't we? Chapter 6, verse 10, through to verse 6 of chapter 7. And so there are these two great things. We said two things that never cease are taxes and death, and that's kind of what he's saying here. There's wealth and the possessions and the danger of that, and then there is a constant reminder of death. As we move into the second half of this third sermon, as it were, really from chapter 7, verse 7 on, the theme is the theme of wisdom. The theme of wisdom. And when you hear that word, I just wonder what it makes you think of. This week I went to the dentist, sitting there, arrived a little bit early, and sitting in the waiting room, there's a lot of Reader's Digest there, which is probably better than some of the magazines you get in waiting rooms. But there was one, and there was one sitting out in its own. All the others were in a neat line. But there's one sitting in its own. I don't know why it was there. Maybe the previous patient had been in and read it. But it had a picture on the front of Jane Fonda. For those of you who don't know Jane Fonda, she's a very famous actress. She's now 85. She's not just a great actor, but her father was a great actor before her in the 30s and 40s and 50s of the last century. And she was a great actress. She was also a great activist, and still is an activist for many causes. She was active against the Vietnam War in America. In fact, she got the nickname Hanoi Jane because she was against the war and stood up and made speeches. And in the 80s, she became a fitness guru. I don't know if you know what videotapes are, but there were videotapes, and people in leotards and bandanas and all were doing exercises. And Jane Fonda was probably the most famous one throughout the world and became rich. Probably in Australia, I don't know, Olivia Newton-John was the equivalent of that. But here's this woman, now 85, great experience in life, many aspects, seems to turn her hand to many things. And the heading in the Reader's Digest was this: Jane Fonda, The Road to Wisdom. And then the subtitle was, The Legendary Actress Talks About the Vital Role That Luck Played in Her Career. So there you have it. Jane Fonda, The Road to Wisdom, Luck. I didn't read the full article, I didn't have time to that, but I was intrigued by it and I went and looked up after. Actually, the reason she was interviewed was she was in an animated film called Luck last year. She was one of the voices. So I don't know if the article's about the movie Luck or her. I think it's not. It's about her view of luck. Because in the Reader's Digest, she said at one point that she remembers getting a wise piece of advice. And it's this: luck is preparation meeting opportunity. By which she elaborated means that you have to be ready, you have to prepare in life and be ready, and then when that moment comes, that lucky moment comes, grab it. Preparation all your life, and then the lucky moment. Grab it. Preparation meeting opportunity. And then in another article, in an article called Parent.com, she wrote, said this about the movie: you can learn from bad luck. It can make you strong. We'll leave that aside for you. It might be wisdom in there, and you can think about that. But there is the wisdom, the road to wisdom of Jane Fonda, the vital role of luck in your life. But Ecclesiastes has taught us that it is God who gives life meaning, not luck. It is God and his personal involvement in his created world, the world that he created and preserves and is active in and governs over. That's what gives us humans purpose and meaning for life. Haven't we seen that already back in chapter 2, verse 24 and following, that we saw that there is purpose with God? And in chapter 5, verse 1 and following, we said that purpose comes when we worship God, and that's why it's good to be here with God's people on the Lord's Day, worshiping him. And we can worship as well throughout the week in our homes. And we've also seen, apart from purpose with God and worship with God, that everything we have are gifts from God. And it's when we realize that everything we have is a gift from God that we can actually enjoy it. Whether it's a relationship, whether it's money, whatever it is, those things will cease at some point and don't last very long. But when we acknowledge they're from God, we can enjoy them, knowing that they're not an end in and of themselves. And what we're seeing now as we're in this third sermon in chapter 7 and 8 is that we can learn the lesson of the knowledge of God, the wisdom of God. It is God who gives wisdom. Wisdom doesn't come through luck and certain experiences in life and us being ready to grasp those lucky moments. So as I say, the main theme from chapter 7, verse 7 to the end of the sermon in 8:13 is wisdom, divine wisdom, not luck, nor Mother Nature, nor any other thing. It is God. It is God's wisdom that we want to look at. And so we'll be doing that the next few times. The next sermon we look at from verse 13 on, we'll look at the fact that wisdom, there's some limitations on it. And we'll look at that next time. Then we'll look at, in chapter 8, the practical use of wisdom. But tonight what we're going to look at in verses 7, particularly 10, but also just looking at the verses after them at the end, is that there's this contrast between folly and wisdom. There's a contrast in these verses between folly and wisdom. And this is why there is this contrast. And you'll see it often in wisdom literature in the Old Testament, particularly in the book of Proverbs. You'll see folly against wisdom. You'll see a negative against a positive. And isn't that a good way of teaching? That sometimes the best way to state a truth is to give a negative statement, to couch it in the negative terms. Probably the best one, I think, and the easiest one to see is the Ten Commandments. The first of the Ten Commandments is, God didn't say, you shall just follow me. He said, you shall have no other gods before me. It was stated in the negative. And when you unpack it and understand what that means, we then see the positive truth. And of the Ten Commandments, eight of them are in the negative. Only the fourth, remember the Sabbath day, and the fifth, honor your father and mother, are stated positively. So it's a good teaching method is to state something in the negative, and then as we look at it and unpack it and think about it, we see the positive truth, and it helps it to underscore the truth and bring the truth home to us. So in these verses 7 to 10, the negative is stated. In other words, the way of folly is stated, and then the positive truth of the way of wisdom is stated. So we grasp what he's saying. One commentator has divided the first 10 verses of chapter 7 in this way. He says verses 1 to 6 are about the tough side of life and how we need to value that, whereas 7 to 10 are about the tripwires of life and how we need to avoid them if we're going to be wise. And so we're looking, if you like, at these tripwires, these traps, the way of folly this evening. And there are just four of them, one in each verse. So let's see how these ways of folly, if you like, can help us understand the way of wisdom. The first one is verse 7, is the folly of extortion. Extortion. Your Bible might have the word oppression at the beginning of verse 7. The ESV has the word oppression. And the word equates to something that has been gained by deceitful means. I don't know if you know people who try to get around their parent or get around their teacher by deceitful means, by using tricks to get what they want. Or people in the workplace, they try and get around. It's the idea that lies behind this word oppression or extortion. And the word extortion is probably a preferable translation, because we see the parallel with the second half of verse 7. The word bribe is used there. So we would read, surely extortion drives the wise into madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Extortion, bribes, that's the way of the fool. And it's therefore a danger to living wisely or to happy having purpose in this life. And notice what we mean by, remember to note what we mean by wise living. Wise living is living in God's way, the way that God has revealed, and the way God has shown us. And it's God has revealed that way, and that is where we get purpose for life and meaning for life. And here in this verse, verse 7, extortion speaks of the misuse of power and or money, wealth in all its forms. And notice that the misuse of money or power affects the heart or the mind. Surely oppression or surely extortion drives the wise into madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart. But remember what we said, that in the Old Testament the word heart is not so much the seat of the affections, the emotions, it's the seat of the mind. And so the wise man is saying here, surely extortion affects our minds and drives us into madness, not into thinking the way God would have us think. And a bribe corrupts our heart, corrupts our way of thinking. You see, extortion or bribing was outlawed throughout the Old Testament. In the book of the law enshrined in the first five books, for example, Exodus 23, verse 8, and Deuteronomy 16, verse 19, extortion, we're told, blinds clear-sightedness. Extortion, bribery, blinds the eyes of the wise. If we're involved in this type of activity, and if this is our attitude and mindset, that we are out to get what we want by deceitful means, it will blind us to the way of wisdom. It also, what we're told in Exodus 23 and Deuteronomy 16, it subverts the cause of the righteous. You see, in God's people, as he says in Deuteronomy 15 and other places, there were to be no poor among you. There were to be none oppressed, none extorted, none bribed. And what is stated in the law in the beginning of the Old Testament is stated in the wisdom literature as well. And that's what we're seeing here in this verse. The greedy, we're told, bring trouble and ruin to their own household, Proverbs 15:27. You don't need me to tell you that. You don't need this, Sam. You maybe have experienced that in society. That the greedy, they bring trouble right into their very own household. While we're commended in Proverbs 14:21 that the generous to the poor are commended. So greed against generosity. And we're told in Proverbs 31:9 that the rights of the poor and needy are to be defended. The reason for all of this appears to be because extortion and bribery and being underhand and trying to gain things in an underhand way, they turn a wise man into a fool, or they make us to be foolish. As Benjamin Shaw says, it forces him into behavior he would not otherwise countenance. If we're using underhand methods, and we may be good people most of the time, but if we use underhand methods, we're going the way of the fool. If we're trying to get around passing that exam by underhand methods, we're the fool. We're the fool. And what are some of the applications for this, for us, in this folly of extortion? Well, just look at the world around you, the world that you live in. Think of some of the words you hear on the news every night in relation to governments, not all politicians, but do we not hear words like sleaze, rorts, scams, pork barreling, lucrative contracts, backhanders, bribes, favors? It's all the language of extortion. And it's throughout our business world, it's throughout our political world. It's how business is done very often. And one of the questions about verse 7 is the wise man, is he the strong person in this encounter? Is he the extorter, or is he the weak person? Is he the extorted person? If the wise man is the strong one in the relationship, if you as a Christian or I as a Christian are doing extortion, what does it mean? Well, it means the successful man, including Christians, might operate in a world of power relationships, and so that's how he lives. He uses power, he uses techniques to get his way. And that can spill over into the life of the church, or into the way we exploit our neighbor, or in the way we live in our family. But if we're the weak one, if we're the one being extorted, then often we're forced into actions that aren't wise, because we've no other option. We're in the weak play position. The way of the fool is the way of extortion. In this life, it's foolish to live like this, because in the end, in this life, if you live like this, you may lose your business, you may lose your investments, you may lose your money, you may lose your freedom, you may lose respect, you may lose your good name and reputation. And in the life to come, you'll have to leave all your extorted riches that you've accumulated behind. You'll leave all of one's deceitfully bribed gains to other people. Isn't that what we've been learning in Ecclesiastes? You don't know who's going to come behind you and receive everything you get. So don't be a fool. Let's not live like this. Let's not live as extorters and bribers, using underhand methods and seeking to maneuver people and maneuvering ways in life. It's the way of the fool. Derek Tidball says, the wise way, even if it is the harder way, is one of absolute, undeviating integrity. The opposite of being a fool in this way is complete, undeviating honesty. Even when we don't see a way out of a situation, we need to be men and women of integrity. The folly of extortion. And one commentator has said that it's really about escapism. It's escapism from responsibility. It's not taking responsibility. It's not taking responsibility for the right way. The second folly we see is in verse 8, and it's the folly of impatience. The folly of impatience. And if the folly of extortion was escapism from responsibility, the folly of impatience is escapism from reality. If you're an impatient person, or if you are impatient in a situation, impatience leads to goals remaining unreached. Tasks remain unfinished. We have a saying in English, don't we? It's a common saying that people say, it's the journey that counts. It's the journey that counts. You know, the end is less important. It's enjoying the journey. I had experience of this when I first came to Australia in 1996, where our kids started going to Westside Christian College, and their first year was really the beginning of 1997. And we met some new parents, and we said, what did you do? And remember, we came from Ireland, which if you drive for 2 hours, you're in the sea, whatever direction. And we said, what did you do for summer? I said, oh, we had a terrific holiday. We took the four boys, and we drove all the way to Perth. All had 2 weeks there and all the way back, and they really enjoyed the journey. I said, really? Really? I couldn't think of anything worse, being in a vehicle for a whole week there. 2 weeks there might be fine, but to have to come back in a vehicle? Coming from Ireland, I couldn't get my mind set on. But it's the idea, the journey's the thing. It's not the end. We live in an age of instant things. I have a friend from America who was here, and he couldn't understand why you would get lemonade and lime and agonistura and make lemon and lime bitters. He said, in America, we just go and buy it in the bottle. That's the world we live in. We don't want to have to mix things. We don't want to have to take time out of our life to mix things. We just want to get a bottle and drink it. We live in an instant world, the age of now. And isn't it interesting what new businesses are called? They're called startups, which probably means they're not going to last long. They'll start up and fold quickly. So this idea of the journey being the thing that counts, we live in a world of instant things. We live in an age of the latest fad or fashion. Music defines your youth, doesn't it? It defines the spirit of an age. I can remember a song back in 1967, which my brother used to play. And one of the lines was, "It's a whole new, whole generation with a new explanation. Put some flowers in your hair. Let's go to San Francisco, the hippie trail. A new generation, a whole generation with a new explanation." That's 1967. How many years ago was that? Has the world changed? Did it have any effect? In a few years, they were fighting wars, and, well, they're still in the Vietnam War and so on. The news cycle is 24/7 news coverage. It hardly changes from moment to moment, but we have to be there watching it and seeing what the latest fad is and the latest fashion. Politicians aren't in it for the long game, unless you live in somewhere like China where you don't have to worry about elections. But it's a three-year cycle. That's the world we live in. And it's a world of impatience. But you see what verse 8 says? Better is the end of a thing than its beginning. The end does matter, not just the journey. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Divine wisdom is that the end is better than the beginning. Completing is important, and more important than just starting, both in earthly and eternal terms. Have you ever heard of someone who was that overnight success? Years in the making, I think. You see, wisdom is about finishing something. I don't know if you ever watched the program Grand Designs. You ever watch that? Do you see the predicament some people get in when they start something? And the weather turns bad, particularly if you're in the United Kingdom or somewhere like that. And you run out of money, and people get into atrocious messes. Wisdom is about finishing. It's about being patient. What are the applications for us? Well, if we're Christians, if we're going to be Christians, and if we're living as Christians, Jesus said we need to count the cost. We need to be finishers. Luke 9 and Luke 14. You need to count the cost. It's not necessarily an easy life. There are going to be times of buffeting when your faith is tried and tested. But you need to finish. You need to go through that, and you need to be finishers. Derek Tidwell, the commentator, said the church, and he was writing back in the late 90s, he said the church is strewn with fools. People who start new ministries, local churches with high hopes and great promises, and it doesn't last. It doesn't, it's not easy, but it requires stamina. An old word, I don't know if it's a real word, is stickability. You've got to stick at a thing and see it through. And so we have the folly of impatience, which is an escapism from reality. The reality is life is not always just straightforward. And it's so easy to begin things, but we've got to finish things and patiently work through life. And that should be a mindset attitude as we work through life, particularly when life is tough. The third folly, then, is the folly of anger in verse 9. And anger is escapism from yourself. What is anger really about? It's blaming the other. The folly of anger. It says in verse 9, be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the heart. Not of the wise, but lodges in the heart of fools. The mark of the fool goes hand in hand with the preceding, doesn't it? An impatient person is an arrogant person often, and arrogance and anger often go together. They're like inseparable twins. I think if one of the marks of our world is all this instant stuff, another mark of the present-day world, I don't know whether it's just here or Western world or whether it's throughout the whole civilized world or the whole world, one mark of modern world is anger. Anger. Do you ever come across anger in your daily life? Ever been in a car park? Driving around? Ever stand in the wrong place or look the wrong way at the wrong person at the wrong time? Do you see anger within yourself? Do you see anger displayed in protests we see in the news every night? What's DV about? Or drunkenness or criminality? What are they about? All you have to do is listen to people. Not only what they say, but look at them when they're saying it. Look at their faces. Sometimes they might be shaking. People are vexed. People are annoyed. People are angry, Proverbs 12:16, and that is the mark of a fool. Can you see how the fool lacks all reason, lacks all sense of control? It says here in verse 9, be not quick to become angry. Didn't we see that in the book of James, chapter 1, verse 19? Be slow to anger. Being slow to anger brings great understanding, Proverbs 14:29. Being slow to anger proves to be mighty and great in might, Proverbs 16:32. The work of the sinful nature of the flesh, we're told in Galatians 5 and 2 Corinthians 12, is anger. It's marks of the spirit, marks of the flesh. And it must be dealt with. Ephesians 4 and Colossians 3, we must put it away, anger. Do not let the sun go down in your anger. The believer, the wise man and woman, will be calm, composed, stable. And I know we get frazzled, and I know there's difficulties in life, but as a general rule, that will mark, that is the mark of wisdom. Do you ever wonder what the possible reason for anger is? Well, we know the fall, and we know sin, but do you know what do you think? Well, it's Probably at least because the fallen man, the fool, doesn't understand the fallen world in which he or she lives. Things go wrong. People will let you down. I'll tell you that. Things will go wrong. You will be disappointed. You'll sometimes disappoint yourself even. You won't always get your own way. The universe doesn't go along with one's wishes and desires. The world doesn't belong to you. So what does the fool do? The fool lashes out. In contrast, the wise person knows there will be disappointment, expects disappointments, knows there are injustices in this world. And often these injustices will never be resolved in this world. There are inequities in this world. The wise person knows that. The wise is not surprised by these things, disappointments and injustices, inequities, when things don't work out. The wise is not surprised by them. He or she stays calm. Yes, we may long for that perfected world, but we stay calm in this world when we have that right perspective. You know, anger may give you a quick emotional release. You let off steam. But it just distorts your vision. It drives others away. And anger doesn't change any given situation for the better. The promises of anger, if there are any, are very short-lived. Whereas the wise will be disciplined and patient. We should go back to verse 8, be patient. It's all about that part of the fruit of the Spirit, isn't it? Self-control. Self-control is a part of the Spirit, Galatians 5 and many other verses. Spiritual discipline, this self-control, this spiritual calmness is to be evidenced in the same way an athlete is dedicated to his or her cause. 1 Corinthians 9:25. Self-control is a required grace characteristic for an elder and leader in the church. And if you read the book of Titus, the little book of Titus, there are many references to self-control. You'll find in Titus that self-control is the mark of a godly older man, chapter 2, 2. It's the mark of a godly younger woman, chapter 2, 5. And it's the mark of a godly younger man, chapter 2, 6. You need self-control. So we have the folly of extortion, which is escapism from responsibility. There's the folly of impatience, which is escapism from reality. The folly of anger, which is escapism from yourself and your own sinfulness and shortcoming. And the final one is verse 10, the folly of nostalgia. Nostalgia. Escapism from the present into the past. Did you hear in the reading in Numbers 11? I've actually been reading through Numbers in my devotions, just happens. And it's interesting, when the first 4 to 10 chapters, things trundle along okay in Numbers, and they're getting set up, how to set up the camp, where each tribe should be, and so on. And then they get into the desert. And between chapter 11 and a few more, one complaint after another. It's complaining about Moses, it's complaining about this, that, and the other thing. And we read one of them. And did you notice what it said a couple of times in the verses that Sam read for us? What was it they longed for? They longed to be back in Egypt. They wanted to be back in Egypt, the place of slavery for 400 years. They said you get great cucumbers and melons. You get leeks and onions and garlic there. Look at, we have to eat this manna. Said, I want to go back to Egypt. Not only is there meat, but the fish is free. Free fish in Egypt. It's called nostalgia. It's called living in the past. And we need to be aware of it. Are you like that? Do you ever talk about the good old days? In your own life? In the life of a church? Christians are pretty good at talking about good old days. If only we had that long list of great preachers. Where have they all gone to? Those great preachers when I was a boy. Where are they? They no longer walk the earth. Well, the church is not packed. When I was a young boy, I couldn't get into church. I had to be there half an hour just to get a seat. What's happened? What about all those attentive children who never spoke out of place. They just sat in their seat and absorbed everything you taught them. Or the young people who took on board everything you said at youth meetings. What wonderful days. We long for the simpler, less complicated days, don't we? They're so much easier, so much better. You could walk around in safety. You could go to the shops down the road and leave the church open or leave the door open. Nothing would happen. I used to be like that when I first came to Australia. I used to keep talking. I made a friend. He came to our church, in a sister church in our denomination. And he was born in Northern Ireland, but he left when he was two. So he's really pretty Aussie. And I used to be going on about Ireland and how wonderful Belfast was. And after a few months, he said, "Look, Jeff, God made Australia too." I said, "Oh, yeah, that's right." And God didn't only make Australia as well as Ireland. He also makes the present and the future as well as the past. Nostalgia can be a tripwire. We can be so bound up with the past that we live in it or we're captive to it. The future can be the same. We can be so absorbed with the future rather than live in the present. Nostalgia can be a tripwire to living God's wisdom. And the fundamental sin in nostalgia is dissatisfaction. I'm dissatisfied with today, where I am. I'm dissatisfied with my lot today. I feel trapped. I feel stuck here in this harsh, complicated world. I don't want to be in this situation. Or I can be dissatisfied with God. Here's why nostalgia or living in the past is so sinful. Think of Numbers, because it's actually anger directed against God. It's dissatisfaction against God. As all sin really is. Just a couple of bits of application. Just remember, the old days were not all good. In Queensland, I can wash my clothes and they're dry in half an hour. In Belfast, it could take a week and still wouldn't be dry. It'd be as hard as cardboard in the snow and ice. So all the things of the past are not all good. We need a dose of honesty about the past. There are good things there. But we need a dose of honesty even in the life of church. I don't mean this local church particularly, but the church general. We need just not a mindset of living in the past, but living in the present, the world that we're in. That is the way of wisdom. If we just are locked into the past, if we've escaped from the present into the past, then it's the way of the fool. And so we have these four ideas of folly. And as you take them and meditate upon them, as you think about extortion and living in an underhand way or trying to manipulate things, or if you think of impatience or anger or nostalgia, it's as you think of those things that should point you to the wise way of living, God's way of living, living for Him. And that's where you will see purpose. In verse 11 and 12, it talks about wisdom's protection. Wisdom will protect you. In verses 13 and 14, wisdom gives you a correct perspective on life. It points you back to God. But here are these follies. Let us learn the lesson of them so that we don't live by them, but that we live in God's appointed way. And we live lives that are full and pleasing to Him, and lives that accomplish great things for Him, and we're not stuck in our own sin, in getting our own way, or stuck in the past. And may it be that we will live the way of wisdom and not the way of folly. Let us pray. Thank you for making your mind and heart and will known in the Scriptures, Father. Help us to understand the way of wisdom. Help us to see the roots of sin in our own heart and help us to put them to death. Help us to be self-controlled people and not angry. Help us to be people who live in the present and for your glory in the present. Help us to be patient. And even when life is difficult, O Lord, and I pray for any of us here tonight for whom life is difficult right now, that they would have patience and would know your presence with them this evening. And help us, O Lord, to do things in your way, not in underhand ways, not seeking to make gain for ourselves. Lord, help us to be wise and not fools. And may we be useful to our Master because we are wise. We ask all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.